Hopefound.org.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlie Englehart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and just keep your dial set to WMNF all day long. WMNF hosts its first celebration of homegrown heroes Sunday, August 19th at the Gulfport Casino. And you can join this conversation celebration. WMNF is honoring Tampa Bay individuals and organizations who are sowing the seeds of equality and peace and promoting social, economic, and environmental justice. Join WMNF for live entertainment, local food, a silent auction, and a celebration of homegrown heroes Sunday afternoon, August 19th from 2 to 6 at the Gulfport Casino. Details at WMNF.org. And we're so glad you're with us. I don't know if you looked at the papers yet this morning, but I was taken aback when I saw the situation in the fire department with firefighter Tanya Vidovic, and also on a different level, the situation with the orca whales.
Oh, the mother, and I was even more alarmed when I realized that they've had no offspring that's survived since 2015, and the numbers they're down to. And I'm hoping you heard Amy Goodman's show, The Climate Change, that special supplement in the New York Times was sobering. But it's been sobering for, what, the last 10, 15 years. I mean, the science has been coming in, but you don't have to depend on science. I mean, look at the temperature of the Gulf. Look at the weather we're having. Look at the wildfires in California and what's happening. I mean, climate change is very real, and nature has such incredible power. And frankly, we're just one of the many living species. And, are we losing Earth? Are we losing our democracy? I'll tell you, we are in the battle of our lives. And it's going to take the very best in all of us. And all of us making a commitment and fighting tooth and nail, because we don't want the last orca whale born. We don't want the last human being born. We don't want to lose our trees. We don't want to lose. And we can't lose this one, people.
And the infrastructure of this country is falling apart, and that will certainly be evident in the second interview this morning with Dr. Mona. But on another note of what you said, I hope you heard Rob's commentary yesterday on the Trump rally here in Tampa, and its obvious importance of us standing up for those things that are important to us.
You know, it's an aspect of human nature, I guess. The more dire things get, the more they look for the savior, the individual who will bring them out of all this fire and brimstone. That isn't that uncommon, actually, and it's a troubling aspect of human beings, but there are also the aspects of human beings like Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha represented in Flint, and all her colleagues who fought so hard to bring attention that, yes, the water in Flint was bad, and it was contaminated with lead, and it was getting into the bodies of their small children and the babies. And so, but that will be in the second hour. And in the first hour, it's all about voting, people. It's about your voice. It's about your participation in this really very, I think, maybe flawed, but at least a democracy that is really worth fighting for and saving. So let me put this little bit of music on, and we are going to come back with Julie Kohler, and she's going to give us some very interesting data and opinions about white women voters. So let me put this on, and we'll come back with Julie Kohler.
Skill, without a loan, don't count.
understand, but I totally agree. We've got to live and care, and we've got to care about our neighbors as well. Okay, well, I'm really excited because with us on the phone, actually, we are bringing back Julie Kohler, and she's actually an excellent analyst, and I'm particularly going to be talking to her about an article she wrote in The Nation, Can White Women Help Bring a Progressive Future, Build a Progressive Future? And if you remember, Julie Kohler is a senior vice president for Democracy Alliance, and that's a progressive donor network. She has a PhD in family social science and serves on the advisory board of Family Story. And so, Julie Kohler, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mary. It's great to be with you.
Well, you know, we were just quickly running through all the disasters.
The
disasters of the day. And so often, Julie, you find that actually it's a matter of attitude. It's a matter of people either having a totally different opinion or perhaps fudging the data, et cetera. And it's a matter of fighting for values, isn't it? And in a democracy, nothing is more important than the vote, is it?
So that's right. That's how things ultimately change. And I think the good news is that we've seen a wave of activism, and that's really been led by women following the 2016 election. And so that's, you know, started in the streets, and I think it's now headed to the voting booth.
And, you know, Julie, you've been such a shrewd observer of voting patterns and particularly following women. And as we know, there's becoming more and more of a difference, if you will, about those who are out protesting, those who are actually, you know, seeing their representatives, et cetera, and the kind of power structure we have in Congress. And I think that's, to me, it's one of the big things that people now seem to have just taken on. You know, they've kind of seized it and said, okay, we know that the representatives in Congress are not really representing our interests, and so we have got to shake the tree, so to speak, and get rid of this rotten fruit. And I was interested to see, I think it was, I don't know, it was in your data or Thea Skocal's data that said like 85% of the calls that are going to representatives, etc., are being done by women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at what's been called the progressive resistance, you know, the kind of grassroots uprising that we've seen since 2016 that has fueled everything from the women's marches to the defense of the Affordable Care Act, the real grassroots organizing and congressional advocacy that sparked all over the country, to now advocacy, you know, opposing Judge Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, kind of any host of issues that we've really seen a dramatic grassroots presence on, it has been overwhelmingly led by women. And so I think that's a really interesting finding. And so it's not inconsistent, honestly, with what we're also then seeing in terms of the surge of women candidates. Women are becoming incredibly politically activated, and they are demonstrating that through all sorts of means, everything from, you know, kind of taking action in their personal lives to contributing to a campaign to attending a march to deciding that it's time for them to run for office themselves.
And, you know, Julie, we've seen somewhat of this before, you know, back about 20 years ago with the Year of the Woman. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the women, we increased the numbers, particularly in the Senate, et cetera. But in terms of and things did change. I mean, in other words, in the last 50 years, things have changed dramatically. But in many, many important areas, you know, whether it's autonomy of her body or it's equal pay or it's, you know, pay for good daycare center, all of these kind of issues, which and also I think with hashtag Me Too, do you think really that this time, so to speak, that push has come to shove, and it's almost like we've come to the Rubicon, and when you have a person like Donald Trump in the presidency, do you think really that women have finally actually seized the sense of analyzing really what's happening and deciding that if they don't do the changes, nothing's going to happen?
Well, I think a few things. So, one, I think that we may be on the brink of a more permanent political realignment in this country. You know, in the 1990s, Pete Wilson, who was then governor of California, supported Proposition 187, which was going to deny social services to undocumented immigrants. And the net effect of that politically was that the Latinx population in California opposed him and opposed the Republican Party and has become a permanent Democratic base. So you now have permanent Democratic majorities in California. I think that Donald Trump may do to white women who have tended to vote Republican overall, and especially to white college-educated women, what Pete Wilson did to the Latinx population in the 1990s. So we may see a group of white women voters that will never again vote Republican. I mean, this is the question. You know, it could go one of two ways, right? It could be that they are just in opposition to Donald Trump and find him so particularly offensive, and then kind of once this immediate threat wanes a bit, if it does, then they may swing back. Or we could be at kind of one of these permanent political shifts. And so I'm really interested both in kind of what kind of organizing would support this being a more permanent, enduring shift? And then what are the personal ramifications? Because people's political identities are largely formed, you know, in the context of their interpersonal relationships, their marriages, their families, their communities. So what are those personal shifts that both drive and result from shifts in political identity?
Yeah, it always interests me that people tend to think upon women as just a very monolithic group. And, you know, that white women actually are the largest single group, a group of voters. And they also, I think they're 39% of all voters in this country. And they're 69% of all women voters. And so many people, I think, tend to see, as I say, that women, you know, are a little more progressive, perhaps a little more democratic, et cetera, as voters. But that's actually not the truth at all. Actually, white women voters have voted, you know, with the GOP, actually, for years. And so now we have come to this Trump dystopia. But, you know, to me, Trump is kind of the end of an era, if you will, of conservative, radical, really conservative politics, which have taken over our Congress. But also, they've kind of taken over our social discourse. And we as women have been fighting very, very hard for the autonomy of our body against, you know, just a barely functioning Supreme Court. And now, with the addition of Gorsuch and, as you said, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, which will very definitely skewer the court even further to be one of the most ideological Supreme Courts we've had, and we've had a lot of them. But then you throw in, you know, the Me Too movement, and you throw in women not being able to get equal pay. But it's not just equal pay. I thought it was fascinating in your article that you're looking, so to speak, at the white woman. You know, like you used the woman in Minnesota. She's a retired special ed teacher and very bright, et cetera. And now she's getting involved in politics, and she's seeing it a little differently. And so is that a big factor in the change, that the women are actually getting engaged now very actively?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this activism is a real force, and I think it will likely, you know, we'll see that in the election outcomes in 2018. We already have in the Virginia gubernatorial election and in the special election in Alabama, there was a significant shift in how white women in particular voted between 2016 and 2017 in those two states. So that is a really important turn to watch. And I want to just say that the reason that I'm kind of focused on white women is, one, because as you said, Mary, they are the largest voting bloc. And so, you know, a shift of a few percentage points can be very determinative in election outcomes. But also, I mean, we need to acknowledge that women of color are already the base of the Democratic Party. They vote overwhelmingly Democratic. They really are the folks who drive progressive social change in this country. And so what I want to make very clear is that I'm not calling for kind of investments in organizing white women at the expense of women of color. If anything, we need much deeper investments in communities of color and women of color in particular, because they're really driving progressive social change. But atop that, I think you have the potential to see this swing in at least certain subgroups of white women that could then lead to an expanded progressive base, not just for 2018 or 2020, but for, you know, many election cycles to come.
Oh, yeah, and I didn't mean in any way to imply, you know, that it is exclusion of African-American women. No, quite the opposite. I have said many times on this show, and I firmly believe it, that the moral character of this country is with African-American women. I mean, coming through the slavery and keeping their families together and all they do. And to me, I'm also looking, you know, kind of historically, you know, with the civil rights movement and women were involved and they kind of got tired of being the secretaries and getting the coffee and really not having much to do with policy. And they realized they had problems too. So then the women's movement began. And I wonder now, you know, that because I think kind of unfairly, but in many ways, there is some validity to feminism, so to speak, being seen as elite white women, that I wonder now, with the Me Too particularly, and really kind of being almost forced, particularly with the kind of predation that Trump has exposed and in your face blatantly with no respect for women. And also then if you also look at the cabinet he has, and you know, women are concerned about the environment, they're concerned about health, they're concerned about the lead in the water for their kids, etc. And you see all these representatives that are head of these cabinet positions, and they are trying to take down all the structures of government, particularly so many of the protective regulatory aspects, that I think women are absolutely shocked. And so I think now, to me at least, it's almost like a real second awakening, if you will, that they're looking at this. And, you know, the chances are, you know, that most of the power people in this country are white men. And, you know, that always with women, with white women, how much, you know, whether it was in slavery, did they identify with their husbands? And did they oppose this? And right now, you know, that they're actually being involved for equal pay and for health issues, et cetera. And I think they've reached the point that so many of them, their husbands, and they have different values. And so do they, so to speak, take a stand and say, well, no, this is what I think is important and we must do because I am concerned about the children of the future. And to me, there's a real, I take a lifting of the veil, if you will, right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, if the second wave, kind of the 1970s feminist movement, was really about, you know, kind of the adage that the personal is political and kind of helping women kind of stop self-blame and take action, I think today's intersectional feminism really has to also address the ways that the political is personal, and that, you know, the way that these things are being lived out in our families and communities. And so the woman that I profiled in Minnesota, because I thought she was very emblematic of dynamics that we're seeing in many relationships and families all over this country, I think is a very good example of that. I mean, she has been politically emboldened in the last 2 years, really transformed, and feels really empowered and proud of the work that she's done, and rightfully so. I mean, she's now, you know, she served as a delegate to the Minnesota Democratic Party's convention. She went kind of under the auspices of an organization that's faith-based organizing, so she came to bring kind of a moral and a faith-based lens to the process. And, you know, and she says she's not stopping anytime soon, but at home, it's been very, very painful. And she talked about that openly with me, you know, that she and her husband, you know, her husband is a Trump supporter. Not only did he vote for Trump, but he continues to support Trump and his presidency. And she really feels like they don't share the same values. And she said, you know, well, I'll never have the level of emotional intimacy that we once had. That's a pretty profound statement. And I just think that we need to, if we're thinking about kind of organizing white women in particular as kind of a progressive force, we need to address and be kind of prepared to, you know, look at how does that play out in relationships and be able to provide other structures where women can receive that social support that they really need.
Yeah, so often, particularly the white women, were very much bound to their husbands, et cetera. You know, even now, you know, when they're out working, et cetera, and I think they're becoming more and more aware that why didn't they get that promotion? Why are they not being paid as much as someone else who's doing the very same job? And I think they're beginning to wonder, what were the factors? Were there factors that I didn't even know because I was so busy being a really good employee and really making sure everything was done right and working so hard, and as you point out, kind of enforcing the rules and really doing it by the book. And I think an interesting statistic is that actually far more divorces now are initiated by women rather than men.
it's always been the case, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, now one is so aware because you tend to think just the opposite, you know, that the man, you know, he wants a younger one person around, all this kind of stuff. But there is really a profound change, and I tend to agree that when Trump is finally gone from the scene, will it go back to business as usual? And I don't think so.
Yeah, and well, one of the things I also wanted to do in the latest piece in The Nation was also look at some of the organizing models that are helping support women in kind of their evolution from political powerlessness or feeling like they don't have political power to a real sense of political agency. And so the organization that I profiled in Minnesota, which is called Isaiah or Faith in Minnesota, they have a whole kind of methodology for how they are working with, and they don't explicitly only work with women, but they find that women are about 2/3 of their volunteer base, of, you know, kind of the crux of who really gets activated with the organization. And one of the things that they work very hard to do, because they're not working exclusively with white women, they work in multiracial settings all over the state, you know, from in about 100 congregations and mosques. So with a pretty diverse base, is they really look at how are they, as they're kind of working to build this sense of political agency, also building racial solidarity. And that, I think, is really critical. Again, if we're looking at how do we build an enduring progressive base, that you have to really see yourself in common purpose with people who are different than you, right, with different backgrounds and so forth, and understand that and kind of be able to value one another and see each, you know, and see yourself in common purpose. That is what's going to lead to an enduring progressive base. But that won't just happen. I mean, like, there's conscious work that actually needs to support that. And that's what I was interested in really examining.
Well, as usual, you examined it well. And again, we've been talking to Julie Kohler, and you can catch her article, Can White Women Help Build a Progressive Future, in the July 16th issue of The Nation. And she's written several articles for The Nation, and you can catch up on them, and they're all very good and well-researched. And so, Julie, we've covered a lot of territory. Is there anything you wanted to mention and clarify before I say goodbye to you?
No, maybe we can reconvene post-election and see how this all plays out. It's always a delight to talk to you, Mary.
Well, I'll probably reconvene with you before the election. Because
that's fine, too.
Because I really think this is so important. So again, Julie, as usual, you're terrific. Thank you so much, and you do take care.
Thanks, Mary.
Bye-bye. And Arlene, did you want to say something?
Just, I wanted to let people know that I'm posting that article in The Nation on our Facebook page. It'll be both on my personal Facebook page and on the From a Woman's Point of View page.
You know, I think one of the really fun things about doing this show is the number of really fantastic women, you know, we get to meet, and I hope you get to meet. And I'm always really impressed by their intelligence, by their passion, by their commitment. And, you know, that we live in a world that's really challenged in so many ways. And I'm sure that so many of you followed here the crisis in Flint water with lead. And I think the thing that's always bothered me about the Flint waters that I realized that there are so many other cities in this country that also have lead problems and in the water, and how serious they are, particularly for children, for young children, babies, pregnant women, and their developing nervous systems. It's really critical. And the story in Flint is pretty extraordinary. And I must admit, I was not aware that there was a very, very serious problem with lead in the water in D.C., Washington, D.C. And it preceded the Flint crisis. And why is that important? Well, because unfortunately that dragged on for 4 years. And actually, not too much was done about it in the sense of recognizing particularly the dangers to children and doing anything about it. And so many of the people involved in that brutal fight with D.C. Actually were involved in the Flint fight, because they had taken their licks, but they learned how to do it. They learned some values. And luckily for the Flint fight, they had the pediatrician you're going to meet by interview. We managed to catch up with her, very busy schedule. She was very gracious and gave us time yesterday. And luckily they had Dr. Mona Atisha, and she likes to be called Dr. Mona. The kids all know her as Dr. Mona. And she was a battler, and with the others, particularly so many of them, people had been so bruised in the D.C. fight that luckily, as opposed to D.C., Dr. Mona and her hard-fighting residents managed to actually finally get some data to show, indeed, the lead levels in the children's blood had changed, and changed considerably when they switched the water. And it's an amazing story. I don't often say this, but this is a book I think you should all read, because it's not only a story of a detective story, so to speak, how to find out, how to do it, but it's a story of a community, because the community, the people of Flint, were so aware the minute that water was switched, the water looked funny, it tasted awful, it smelled, and during the summer when the kids, you know, kids go out and they play around hydrants, that people were horrified that the water that came out was black and brown, and their skin broke out, they lost their hair, they had all kinds of miscarriages because lead actually is an abortifacient, and yet everybody, the officials said, it's fine, the water is fine, don't worry about it, it's fine. And the people were absolutely right, it wasn't fine. And it took Dr. Mona and some of her colleagues to actually give the values, because unfortunately, in this country, and it doesn't always apply in the rest of the world, that in this country, we don't follow the precautionary principle. We do not think that until something is proved to not be harmful, don't use it. Don't expose everybody to it. No, here it's just the opposite. And you certainly have seen the case with lead. And if you get and read the book, you will have a chapter on lead. I don't think you'll forget. And that unfortunately, the United States went against the rest of the world because lead was taken out of any kind of products in Europe in 1926. And we said, nada. And there we are in 1940. We have found tetraethyl lead to add to gasoline, so the gasoline, so it doesn't knock. And it was developed by Dr. Kettering of GM. And Dr. Mona has some very strong words about Dr. Kettering, and I think you should all become aware of lead and lead levels, because doctors feel that there is no safe level of lead, particularly for children, in water or in food. It should be zero. And that actually that the health departments look upon 5, well, okay, they'll tolerate that. But they don't do anything until the lead levels in water and other areas reach 15 parts per billion. And what does that tell you to begin with? The average infrastructure of water in this country is well close to 100 years old. They are lead pipes. They've had to change the corrosion controls. They no longer use chlorine because it's not effective against all the pathogens that are in the water. So they have chloramines now. They are far more corrosive, so you really have to have very careful corrosion control in order to ensure the safety, and it is an art. And like a city in Detroit has 20 involved in corrosion control. Flint had one half-time person. They didn't even have a pump. And that actually was the critical data when Dr. Mona's friend said, how is the water in Flint? Because she was one of the many EPA people that took the bruising in D.C. And she said, I have checked thoroughly. And she said, they are not using any corrosion control. So anyway, it is a fabulous book, and let me get started because I really want you to hear Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha.
Right.
Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, and she's a pediatrician at Hurley's Children's Hospital. She's an assistant professor at Michigan State University's College of Human Medicine, but in addition to that, she's a scientist, activist, who's been called to testify twice before the United States Congress, awarded the Freedom of Expression Courage Award from Penn. She was named a Times 100 Most Important People, and you all know her, I think, or not all, but most of the listeners of this station know her from her heroic work in Flint about the lead crisis, and she has written an extraordinary book that honestly I think should be a read for everyone, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. So it is such a privilege to welcome you, Dr. Atisha, to the show.
Thank you, Mary. It is great to be with you.
Well, you know, your book is so profound in so many levels. And particularly, I'm thinking about, I think, a real time of crisis in this country where you and your family wouldn't even be allowed to come. And I don't know if you would have had, if you were here, the kind of opportunities. And your dedication and your love of the children of Flint, to me, came from kind of the love and the culture that you had with your parents and their parents. I mean, honestly, the flow from Baghdad, one realizes the importance of a whole community and this continuum.
Absolutely. So this book is so much more than just about Flint and our water crisis. It's a memoir, so it talks about, you know, how I came to be in Flint, and it is very much that immigrant story. I came to this country at the age of 4, fleeing tyranny, oppression, dictatorship, fascism, and Lady Liberty welcomed her arms to me and my family, and I grew up competent and confident, proud of the diversity that I brought to the table, and you know, we just have to take a moment to reflect, because that is not happening right now for the 4-year-olds who want to come to this country for that American dream. And you got to wonder what we're missing out on.
Yeah, you look at what's happening right now at the border, and you see the separation.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I can only imagine the grief that causes you, because you, more than anyone, would be aware of the terrible toxic stress that these parents and these kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's how as a pediatrician, we know that what that does, that toxic stress causes lifelong developmental scars. It is government sanctioned child abuse. As a mother, it's heartbreaking. You know, as an immigrant, you know, it adds this other layer of damage.
And, you know, Dr. Atisha, just this morning in our paper, I was reading that they've done lead levels in our schools. So they've tested 50, and 27 of them, the levels were high. And so now they're going to test all the levels in the school. And if they had read your book, they would realize just what a serious problem lead is, and also lead in our water. And you know, the most amazing thing about your book, and I'm going to thread through the story, because I think this honestly should be required reading for every American.
Thank you. I
really do right now, because, you know, without your parents and the grief they were going through, you know, they wanted to go back to Baghdad, but they were getting the letters of what was happening. They knew it was too dangerous. And so the pressure you saw on that, and then you saw some pictures of what Saddam Hussein had done in Iraq. And so you were already aware that government could be very bad. But there,
you got it.
There you are, this dedicated doctor, but also the influence of your friend Ellen. And so I'm thinking of you, and I know I'm jumping ahead here, but there you are, you're head of the residence of pediatrics, you know, at Hurley, and you're very busy, and you absolutely just love the kids you treat. It's just a pure delight to see that love throughout the book. And so, but your friends, your childhood friends, and a couple of them, you had fought for environmental factors when you were kids. You were in high school, et cetera.
Right.
And Ellen had worked for the EPA, and you knew something had gone wrong slightly, and that something had really kind of soured her, and she was kind of discouraged. And there you are at a barbecue. And but I guess we should start actually with the Flint water had been cut off from its source from Detroit, in April of 2014?
Yeah.
A big civic deal. They pushed the button, et cetera. But now this is in 2015, and your friend is at this barbecue. She's an environmental engineer. She knows a heck of a lot about water. And she asks you, how is the water here in Flint? What are you knowing about the water here in Flint?
Yeah, so Ellen is an old childhood friend, a drinking water expert, was at the EPA during a very similar lead and water crisis in Washington, D.C. a decade ago. And it was a last-minute barbecue at my house, quick texting, can you come over? Sure, I can come over. Our kids were playing together. And she cornered me in my kitchen and drilling me, her eyes really boring into mine, quizzing me about Flint water. And she had seen a memo from a former colleague of hers at the EPA that was warning that the water in Flint was not being treated properly, and because of that, there would be lead in the water. And that was a moment that changed my life. Before that, we'd heard about concerns about the water, but never the word lead. And when a pediatrician hears the word lead, there is only going forward, because we know what it does to our children, and especially what it disproportionately does to our underserved children. So from that moment on, I stopped sleeping, I stopped eating, it became a coffee-only diet, and it became really kind of this quest to find out if the lead in the water was getting into the bodies of our children.
But it was interesting because the water was switched in 2014, and almost from the get-go, the people who were receiving this water said it's discolored, it stinks, it tastes bad. And then a minister actually saw the kids playing, how kids play in hydrants, you know, in the summer, and he realized that it was black and brown, and he thought, what is in this water? So citizens had been rallying, and they had been saying, what's wrong with this water? But they also, being you're such a fine pediatrician, and they love you, they trust you, and so they're bringing their kids in, and invariably you're checking these babies and these small kids, and the mom will ask, what about the water? What about the water? And you said, it's fine. It's tested. And you being a competent professional trusted other competent professionals.
Of course. I mean, this is America, the richest country in the history of the world. This is the 21st century. It is not 19th century London with cholera epidemics. We in Michigan are literally in the middle of the Great Lakes, which is the largest source of fresh water in the world. But despite all that, there are rules and regulations and people whose only job is to make sure that when we turn on our tap, the water is safe. So I had no reason not to believe these government officials who kept saying that everything was okay with the water. And thus, I was telling my patients that everything was okay with the water.
Yeah, and there you mentioned very briefly that the Great Lakes are the largest repository of fresh water in the world. And there, Michigan sits right in the middle. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine that any city in Michigan, being so close to this enormous bodies of water, would have any problems. And I have to admit, Dr. Atisha, I had not heard about the D.C. crisis, and I thought, how could I have missed this? But fortunately, and that D.C. crisis had really soured your friend Ellen, but also you had a member of the EPA, Miguel Del Toro, and he was very damaged because he said this water is not safe. You know, it's got the lead, et cetera. And Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech is also doing the testing, and it was just a four-year standoff. And I thought, how could I have not known this, et cetera? But then you start to dig in. And Ellen also starts to dig in because I'm sure that she and Del Toro, both of them had terrible frustrations because they knew the dangers of lead. But then you started to get the doors closed in your face, didn't you?
Yeah, so really just like everybody else who had raised concerns about this crisis, I was also getting nowhere and getting dismissed and denied. So, you know, the people of Flint for 17 months, a year and a half almost, were complaining, rightly so. The water was discolored and it tasted weird and it looked weird and it smelled weird. And we had bacteria in the water and we had so much chlorine added to the water, and that irritated people's skin and eyes. And then the most striking thing, the biggest red flag in this whole story, was when General Motors, which was born in Flint, still has plants in Flint, just after a few months of the water switch, stopped using this water because it was corroding their engine parts. And they got a bypass to go back to the Great Lakes. So many red flags throughout that really should have ended the crisis. We also knew that there were, we started to find out about the lead in the water, scientific proof that, you know, lead was in the water in every neighborhood, you know, every part of the city. And Mark Edwards, who brought that to light, was also dismissed and attacked. So when I tried to find out about children's lead levels, I couldn't get anywhere, so we did the research from our own hospital records to see what was happening with kids' levels and very publicly shared that research, and that was also attacked and dismissed, that there was nothing wrong.
And I think that it's really troubling because very early you found that what this nurse that was for public health up in, was she in Detroit or wherever she was, that they had found this spike. She inadvertently, I think, mentioned that to you. And you were trying so hard to get that data because you knew you needed data. That's one thing. And I think, let's spend just a minute, because lead is such a red flag to pediatricians. But I think people know enough to know how bad that particular is to children, particularly the developing nervous systems of children. And here you are in Flint, General Motors, et cetera, and Kettering. And just real briefly, because I think it really says a lot about this country, the story of lead and how it became such a huge problem, particularly not only with the paints, but with gasoline. And so would you real quickly go through that? Because that's quite a story in your book.
Absolutely. So there's lots of deep dives into history in this book, but they're really dramatic page-turning deep dives, not snoozers. And we need to know history. We need to know how we came to be for our cities and a lot of our policies and you know, legacy, especially legacy contamination. So the history of lead is absolutely evil with so many turns and twists. You know, in the 1920s, Europe banned the use of lead paint, and the very same year, we put it in our gasoline when we knew it was bad, when we had alternatives, but to make a profit because General Motors had a patent on tetraethyl lead, and it was led by Charles Kettering, this renowned engineer that everybody really is aware of him. You know, he has done so much for General Motors, but, you know, Memorial Sloan Kettering, a huge philanthropist. But it was his, you know, actions that put lead in gasoline that contaminated the entire world with lead. You know, lead was even found in, you know, ice in the glaciers because of the use of lead in gasoline. And that was born in Flint as well. So we have a long, long legacy of dismissing science, dismissing facts, dismissing children's health, predominantly for corporate greed.
And again, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and we are talking right now to Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisa, who has written just an extraordinary book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in American City. And particularly, we're talking about Flint, but unfortunately, we could be talking about a lot of other cities beside Flint. And to me, it's stunning when I was reading that, and I think that's one of the best parts of your book, how you really bring in the history, that there Europe bans this thing, and there you have Kettering that's really working so hard, you know, to find something that stops the knocking in engines. And, you know, there were so many other agents he could have used. But also, then you bring in some real heroes in public health, like Lucy Hamilton. And there's Alice Hamilton, and she is fighting tooth and nail against this and knows how dangerous it is. But also, a kind of in an adjunct, Jon Snow, and how he fought. In other words, all that, and also then your great mentor for environmental justice, Dr. Bundy, at Michigan State. In other words, all of these giants, if you will, become such an important factor in all of our lives, and we might not even totally know it, but their doggedness and their, you know, persistence in the scientific method, if you will. But also, you know, your book is an absolute testimony to the importance of community and public health, if you will, that, you know, that you can't just look at a child's disease. You've got to see that entire environment. And and also, the tragedy, really, of Flint is the emergency managers that, you know, with the kind of starving that they do to states and counties here in this country with our economic... The story is the day. And that's what happened so much in Flint, because Flint really, just as D.C., really, as you said in your book, they didn't really have representative government.
You're right. Lost democracy. Yeah, and that's why this book, and Mary, you've touched on everything so brilliantly. Thank you. But that's why this book is not just a story about Flint. Like you said, it could be anywhere, because these are the crises that we're facing all around this nation in terms of democracy, lack of democracy from gerrymandering, voter disenfranchisement, mass incarceration, environmental injustice issues because of austerity and inequality, the disrespect for science. So clear-cut science was dismissed in Flint. But we see that right now with climate change denial and what's happening with vaccines and the threats to the EPA's, you know, regulations. There's so much in this story that resonate with today. And that's not even touching kind of the immigrant part of the story. But ultimately, it's a story about these deeper crises, but it is a story about activism and resistance, which we all need to hear right now. It's about how ordinary people came together and said, we're not taking this anymore, and banded together to fight for children. And it is a story about how we came together to provide hope, especially for our most vulnerable populations.
Oh, I cannot second that enough. I mean, every part of this book, really. You know, I fell in love with your mother and father, but also, you know, your husband, your kids, but also your distant relative Nuri. I mean, you know, the rebel he was, and you know the influence he had. But also, I'm going back, you know, because we saw the fallout, the damage, the people that tried so hard in D.C. Because what, something like 42,000 kids were exposed, and nothing has been done, and still not being done about it. And you know more than anyone the dangers of lead, particularly to the nervous system and to the children. And you know, one thing about your book that I really found tragic, really, but also very informative, that we, you know, I've been quite aware of the dangers of lead paint and, you know, how that bad that is for children. And you point out that lead, particularly white paint with lead, tastes very sweet. Mm-hmm. And so babies really mm-hmm. would put that in their mouths. But, mm-hmm. you know, I had never thought about, we know all the dangers of guns and the violence in society. Mm-hmm. And I had not thought about the fact that children who had been shot, and unfortunately mm-hmm. there are way too many of them, actually many of them have still fragments of lead in their body. And that, too, contributes to this whole lead burden that these children have.
Yeah, so lead is amazingly still in use, and one of its uses is in bullets, also fishing materials. It's also still in use in jet fuel. But, you know, before this water crisis, we in Flint, because of the high rates of violence, actually had children with elevated lead levels because of retained bullets in their bodies. Just imagine the incredible trauma and toxicity, not just from the lead exposure, but, you know, the trauma of that crisis that these children will bear for their whole lifetimes.
And Dr. Atisha, you know, one of the things I've always admired about pediatricians is how much they love those children. I mean, they really love their children. And that's great. I think that is fabulous. And I love the fact that you follow, particularly two little patients you had, Reva and Nicola, her little sister, and how much you thought about them and thought, oh, you know, because the little one is like only 6 months old or something like that, or really small. And the mother is working, so she can't continue breastfeeding. And so the mother really wants to get on formula, and you know, she asks, and she keeps asking, is the water safe? Is the water safe? And you just really love these little two kids. I mean,
my kids in Flint are no different than my children, and that is absolutely how I treat them. And my real children acknowledge that. They're like, Mom, it's like we have 6,000 siblings. and that is how every provider should care for their patients, as if they were their own.
But I thought that story was so great, because the activists and the people from the start knew that there was something wrong, and they were fighting.
Of course.
And they already had brought in Mark Edwards, and Otoro was trying. But really, frankly, the real key linchpin is when you got the blood levels and you could show with scientific data how much it increased. Because actually, people for years in this country have been trying to reduce the lead levels in paint and stuff all like that. It's illegal. And so the lead levels in kids have been going down. And so if you see it staying the same or going up, that's really a red flag. But what I really loved is that you worried so much about Reva and little Nicola, and then when you talked to them toward the end again, because you follow Grace, their mother, and the children, and so luckily the godmother, this aunt of little Nicola, did not like the water. She said, don't use that water for your children. And so even though Grace, their mother, couldn't afford bottled water, she did. The godmother gave them bottled water, and so at least that from the get-go with the formula, Grace was filling the formula with
Absolutely.
And I thought that was so beautiful. And I thought, because it tied together. In other words, you were a huge part, but you were only one part of this incredible community effort. And I thought the best thing about you, Dr. Atisha, is that after Snyder and the representatives, you know, from the water management there, the health services, who had really been lying and pillaring you and all the rest of them, that really, you know, and many of them have gotten their comeuppance, so to speak. But I thought it was interesting. You compared it to Saddam Hussein. You said, well, he deliberately poisoned people and children. You did not think any of them deliberately did. And I think it's that kind of effort that we have to do to come together to kind of not look so much for enemies, but what can we do?
And that's especially now when we're so divided as a nation, we need to find our villages and our teams. And it's unexpected. People that don't look like us, don't vote like us, don't have the same professions as us, came together here. And that's what we need to do everywhere.
And Dr. Mona, I'm really curious because you really, you know, that you've given testimony in Congress about the lead copper, you know, values, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But you also are trying to do a whole picture, so to speak, following Alice Hamilton. And so you have started a center, you know, where the children will get all the nutrition, all the kind of psychological support, the mental stimulation to try and undo some of this damage. So I think it's so important that you want to be part of the solution in Hurley. So
absolutely.
What are you doing with that in mind?
Yeah, so, you know, Flint is a story where common sense science was denied and dismissed. Ultimately, it was our science that spoke truth to power. And we, from the moment that we recognized we were in this crisis, we have been using the incredible science of child development, of toxic stress, of resilience to mitigate, to limit, to buffer the impact of this crisis. This crisis was not just lead. We had lots of things in this crisis, Legionnaires, deaths, people died, and thus there's homicide charges against officials. We have skin issues, but really it's a crisis of the trauma of trust, betrayal, anger, guilt, fear, and all of those emotions are added toxicities that impact outcomes. So when we've framed it this way, it's given us a playbook of interventions, and we are throwing everything that is science-based at our children right now to promote their development. So things like home visiting programs, two brand new child care centers, near universal preschool, early literacy programs, two generation literacy programs, Medicaid expansion, mobile grocery stores, nutrition prescriptions, mindfulness in schools, breastfeeding support, and the list goes on and on. And we are working on the bigger things like restorative justice and self-determination and jobs, because this is a city that needs jobs. But we now have jobs for like school nurses and plumbers and pipe fitters and research assistants. So Flint is on this incredible path towards recovery, and that is what we hope to share, that people do not remember Flint as a crisis, but rather remember Flint as what we are doing next. And in my very academic, data-driven hat, we will share with you what we learned to help other communities, because there are so many kids in this nation growing up with very similar toxicities, not only the toxicities of lead, but the toxicities of poverty and lost democracy and racism and discrimination and violence and unemployment. And we want to be able to make an impact on all of those children.
And you said you'd share that information. Well, how would people, if they're interested, get information like that?
Yeah, so they can check out our website, but we also were just funded to build a Flint registry. So this is very much modeled after big registries like the World Trade Center Registry, where we are identifying folks who are exposed, getting them connected to the services, but following them long term. So this is going to be our biggest kind of data repository that we will then push back our results out to share what's working and what's not working and where our gaps are. So that's going to be the biggest way where we share our information.
And again, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, Florida, and we've been talking to Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha and her book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. And honestly, I don't often say this, but I think it should actually be required reading, because it is just hope and ability, and it really restores the faith that, you know, that your love of those kids was so deep that you were not going to let anything stand in the way. And without all the love you had from your parents, your community, mm-hmm. your friends, mm-hmm. you couldn't have done that. And so to me, it's hope. It's everything about it is hope. And thank you so much for all you're doing and writing this book, because it's really, I think, an important book for right now.
And thank you, Mary.
And I really do appreciate you and your whole team. And keep up the great work, because I imagine that there are many Flints, unfortunately, in this country.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, and you do take care.
Oh, Mary, you're great.
Oh, you. she was very gracious. She's a very, very gracious person. But anyway, again, I really mean it. I think if you want hope in this world, and also activists, and put it all together, it is a synopsis that we need. So, Arlene, do you have anything you wanted to say?
I just wanted to mention that there will be a march by the Immokalee farm workers, or supporting the Immokalee farm workers, and that will be this Sunday from 2:30 to 3:30, stepping off from the Allendale United Methodist Church in St. Petersburg. And it's, as I mentioned, protesting Publix and Wendy's and their refusal to give the increases that would increase the payment to the workers.
so much money. And unfortunately, I think it becomes a disease. You know, you've got to have more, got to have more. And we've got plenty of wealth. It just isn't distributed very well. Okay, you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. And do keep it tuned here all day because it's the kind of information you need to kind of do something in this world. And we certainly need all of you doing what you can now. So thanks so much and try and make it a better world.